This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalziel Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Welcome to this month's Ask an Astronomer segment. I'm joined in the studio by Ian McDonald, who is going to be answering some questions asked of us during the Blue Dot Music Festival. Let's get started. Fern Batty asks, how did planets form?
Well, these are some of the questions we got asked by some of the younger attendees. They're some of the most basic questions we can ask in astronomy, and they're questions that we've been wondering about since we first understood what stars and planets actually are. Yet it's only in the last 50 years or so that we've really understood how these processes work. We're still trying to understand a lot of this fundamental physics today. It's only in the last 20 years or so that we've found out why we have the types of stars around us that we do, and the rich diversity of planetary systems that come along with them. The basic principle behind forming stars is that you need to start with a cloud of gas and dust, and you need to make it cool and dense enough for it to collapse in on itself through gravity. That cloud might initially be light years across, but might collapse down to only a handful of stars. Once this collapse happens, dense clumps start to form, and gas particles and dust grains in those clumps will start hitting each other, and that heats the clumps up. If one of these clumps becomes too hot, it'll simply evaporate. But as the clumps collapse, they also drag in the cloud's magnetic field, and this magnetism helps keep the clump together. The dust in the clump helps insulate it from harsh radiation outside, but dust is also good at cooling the cloud, so it helps stop the clump heating up. Now, this collapsing cloud isn't smooth. There's turns and twists in it, and there's overdensities and underdensities, and these collapse down into filamentary structures, dense spaghetti-like lines along which material can collapse and be pulled down into the collapsing clump. The material flowing down these filaments doesn't always come straight down into the clump, and it will start to spiral, and like a figure skater pulling in her arms, that spiral becomes faster and faster, and the clump gets smaller and smaller, and it starts to rotate, and that gives the clump a pole and an equator. Now, material coming down to the poles of the forming star comes straight down to the centre of the clump, but material coming down to the equator will be rotating. The centripetal force will help keep it away from the centre, and this means that the clump starts to flatten into a disc shape. So now we have a clump that's collapsing, it's heating up, it's starting to rotate, and it's starting to flatten into a disc, and its magnetic field keeps getting stronger and stronger. As the clump is getting denser, dust grains and gas molecules start to collide together and grow. And in the centre, that part that will become the star, this happens very quickly as the gas and dust starts to form one large solid blob. This becomes the central star. Further out, gas and dust is slower to stick together and starts to settle down to a smooth protoplanetary disk of growing dust grains. The slow gravitational squeeze in the central star starts to generate a lot of heat. And this starts warming the star up and eventually it starts glowing with heat. In its core, the temperature rises from close to absolute zero to thousands and then millions of degrees. And at this point, hydrogen nuclei bind together so hard, they fuse, forming helium and letting out more heat. This is the start of nuclear burning that breathes life into the growing core of the star. And the star is born. This nuclear fusion will power the star, keeping it glowing brightly until it dies, many millions or even billions of years later. However, for now, the star is still collapsing and slowly getting hotter. Material close to the star gets trapped by the magnetic field and funneled onto the surface. And meanwhile, radiation from the brightening star starts to evaporate any dust that's close to it. This truncates the disk that's forming around the star, and the disk starts to evaporate, and any gas and dust that could form for planets is blown away. So a race is on. If the star gets too bright too quickly, the protoplanetary disk will evaporate, and no planets will form. If the dust and the disk can stick together fast enough, planets can form, even large planets. But the problem with this is that dust is quite fluffy, so it's quite easy to grow small, fluffy dust bunnies. But it's hard to get these bigger than about a metre across without them breaking apart, a bit like a powdery snowball. It's got to be done slowly and gently. But if you can grow something a few metres in diameter, colliding pebbles can embed themselves into its surface, and the pile of rubble can start to grow. Once it approaches a few kilometres across, gravity slowly starts to take over, starts squishing the fluffy dust together into rock. And if it gets to a few tens of kilometres in size, that rock starts melting. Once it reaches about 1,000 kilometres in size, it can grow big enough to start clearing out its orbit, and maybe form an atmosphere. Planets further from the star have less material to work with, because the protoplanetary disk isn't so dense that far away from the star. But they've got a big advantage. After hydrogen and helium, oxygen is the most abundant element in the universe, and a lot of the gas around the star consists of water vapour. Far from the star, this water vapour can condense into ice, and pebbles can grow quickly into large planetary cores, many times the size of the Earth. Beyond this ice line, large bodies can grow while there's still enough gas to accrete into an atmosphere. If a lot of ice and gas can be trapped into a planet, a gas giant planet will form. But inside the ice line, rocks can't grow very quickly, so all the gas has disappeared before planets become big enough to keep hold of it through their own gravity. So we end up with rocky planets like Earth. We think that most stars have planetary systems like this. There's a final factor we haven't considered. Planetary migration. These newly formed systems are unstable. Forming planets interact with each other and with the protoplanetary disk through the gravity and how they accrete material. And this can mean that planets move around or swap places. We think this is how hot Jupiter planets form, either by migrating inwards through the disk of the protostar or being gravitationally scattered into very small orbits through interactions with other planets. Planets can also be eaten by their star if they stray too close, or they can be ejected from the star system entirely. It's these processes that I've been studying for the last 3 years. We don't know how many ejected planets there are out there, but there could be as many of these free-floating planets as there are stars. We know of a handful of these planets already, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to find some new planets using this method very soon.
Since we're on the subject of planets, we've got a question about the moon. Luxia asks, where did the moon come from?
Well, I figured that we could talk about moons as well, since we're discussing how planets form. Our moon's quite unusual. Most of the moons in the solar system are around giant planets, and typically these form like mini solar systems, with the same kind of cloud of gas and dust condensing around the giant planet as it condenses around a protostar. If you look at moons like the Galilean satellites of Jupiter, or most of the moons of Saturn, this is how they were formed. Many other moons in the solar system are captured asteroids or Kuiper Belt objects. If you look, for example, at Neptune's moon Triton, or Saturn's moon Phoebe, or Mars's moons, this is where we think they came from. But the thing about all these moons, they're quite small compared to the planet they orbit. The moon, our moon, is quite big. It's about the diameter of North America, and it's about an 1/80th of the Earth's mass. The only other large body that we know of in the solar system with a similarly large moon is Pluto. And just like Pluto and Charon can be thought of as a binary dwarf planet, the Earth and our moon can be thought of as a binary planet too. So how did the Earth get an exceptionally large moon? If we look at material that's been brought back by the Apollo astronauts, we see that rather than being made of green cheese, the moon's actually made of very similar material to the outer layers of the Earth. And in particular, if we look at the oxygen and titanium isotope ratios, they're so identical to the Earth's, the moon and the Earth must have formed from exactly the same material. The best hypothesis we can come up with to explain this is a major collision towards the end of the planet building process. So long after the dust grains had coalesced into pebbles, and the pebbles stuck together to form boulders, and the boulders collided to form planetesimals, the planetesimals collided together to form larger and larger planetesimals. Now, once planetesimals get to a few tens of kilometers across, they can't lose heat efficiently. And in the early solar system, there was a lot of radioactive aluminium around, and its radioactive decay heated up the cores of the planetesimals, making them molten. This made collisions between planetesimals a little bit more splashy. And what we think happened in the moon's case is that the Earth, which is almost as big as it is now, was hit by a body about the size of Mars. We think it's a fairly glancing blow that knocked some big chunks of the early Earth out into space. And eventually those chunks settled into orbit around the Earth and coalesced back into a single body, which is what we see as the moon today. This all happened within the first few million years after the sun started burning hydrogen. And at the time, the moon would have been a lot closer to Earth than it is today. Both the Earth and the moon would have been completely molten, heated up by meteorite impacts, gravitational contraction, and radioactive aluminium. But slowly, crusts began to form over both bodies, and the lava centered around volcanic hotspots. Since the moon is smaller and doesn't have an insulating atmosphere, it cooled a lot quicker, and it's now a semi-solid body. But the Earth, being bigger, retained its heat a lot better, and it still has plate tectonics and volcanic activity today. So the moon acts as an archive for understanding the early solar system and the processes that went on in forming the early Earth. That early geological record's been erased on Earth. Our rocks just simply aren't that old. So we need to go to the moon and other minor bodies in order to understand these formation processes. Now, the formation of the moon required a situation that was just right at the end of the planet building in our solar system. The moon regulates our tides and it keeps the Earth's rotation axis stable. And these factors may have been vital components in bringing together life on Earth. While we have at least one good candidate, we don't have any confirmed moons around planets outside our solar system. So we don't know how common the formation of large moons around terrestrial planets is. But understanding this process could be an important point in understanding how many other planets in our galaxy could support life.
Lastly, Alex S. asks, how many planets are there in the universe?
Well, these days there seems to be a new planet discovered every other day. That's actually statistical average. We know of over 4,000 of them in total. So it might come as quite a surprise to know that we still don't have a good idea of how many of them there are out there. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. One of them is that it's easier to detect big planets and planets near their star. It's hard to detect small planets or planets a long way from their star. So we have a good idea of the number of Jupiter-sized planets around the average star. We've got a reasonable idea of the number of Neptune-sized planets around the average star. But we still don't have a good idea of how many rocky planets there are. Now, ongoing missions like TESS and upcoming missions like PLATO will help detect small planets close to their stars. But it's still going to be really difficult to detect planets a long way from their stars. For that, we need the patience to sit and watch millions of stars for several years until we can make repeated detections of a few rocky planets. So far, however, we might guess that the average Sun-like star has maybe 3 planets or so, but we don't know how accurate that guess is. The average number of planets probably also depends on the kind of star you're looking at. Massive stars, stars bigger than the Sun, tend to have more planets, and smaller stars have fewer. But it's very difficult to detect planets around stars more than about 1.5 times the mass of the Sun, because they don't have sharp spectral lines with which we can measure the wobble of the star as the planet orbits it. It's also very difficult to detect planets around very small stars, because they don't produce very much light from which we can make our measurements. On top of this, older stars and stars at the edges of galaxies probably don't have enough dust-forming metals to nucleate large planetary cores, so they probably have fewer planets too. So we don't know how many planets a typical star has if you average it over the entire galaxy. However, we can say that the Sun's a fairly typical star, so let's just guess that we have about 3 planets per star. Using this very rough guess, we can multiply by the number of stars to get an idea of the number of planets in the universe. We know that there are about 400 billion stars in our galaxy, so that means we can expect roughly 1.2 trillion planets. We also know that there are about 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe, so we might expect something like 100 sextillion planets out in the universe. And that's only the part of the universe we can see. There's probably a whole lot more universe out there that we can't. We were also asked by another Blue Dot attendee how many Earth-like planets there are in the universe. Now, obviously, that depends on what you mean by Earth-like. If we say Earth-like is a planet about the size of ours, in an orbit like ours, where the temperature is just about right for liquid water on the surface, then most stars probably have at least one planet that meets these criteria. So there might be hundreds of billions of Earth-like planets in our galaxy, and tens of sextillions of Earth-like planets in the wider universe. But that definition includes planets like Venus, where the greenhouse effect baked the water off the planet, and Mars, which didn't have the right combination of mass and density and magnetic field to keep hold of its water. So planets with oceans like ours might be much rarer, and there might only be tens of billions of ocean-bearing worlds in our galaxy. Of course, by Earth-like, you could mean a planet with life. We don't know enough about astrobiology to predict how often the conditions for life occur, but even if the probability that a planet with an ocean forms life is a billion to one against, the galaxy should still have a good selection of alien life out there, and the wider universe could have a lot more. So statistically, it seems unlikely that we're alone. However, what we've found from science is that the reality is a lot stranger than fiction. There will be a lot of planets out there that we simply haven't even thought possible. Things that will surprise us and things we didn't expect. Planets like hot Jupiters rocked the astronomical community when they were first discovered, and we can expect similar discoveries in the future. The first alien life we find, if we do, is almost certain to be something completely different to our expectations. But one thing is clear for now. There's plenty of planets for us to go looking at.
All right. Thanks a lot for that, Ian. Back to the studio.